Hello, everybody, and welcome to the Dry Dock, episode 352. This week, the questions are taken from guide 422 on the Göteborg, or let's face it, Gothenburg, or Town-class destroyers of the Swedish Navy, as well as the video on Admiral Spruance's career covering the time from Saipan to Okinawa. So, let's start with questions. Captain Charlemagne asks, why do some people looking from the bow view think that Gneisenau is Bismarck? I saw a photo of Gneisenau in 1939 in Kiel, and someone vehemently defended that it was in fact Bismarck, which I find a little bit silly. Well, I mean, at a very, very superficial level, they look kind of similar, but you know, you'd expect that because they're both German fast battleships with a design period that's within a few years of each other, at least if you're looking at post-Atlantic bow. Gneisenau or Scharnhorst, as you can see here, Gneisenau, just in case you're wondering, is on the left. But, well, there are a few rather major giveaways as to which ship is which. The most obvious one being, well, one of them's got triple turrets, the other one has twins. That's rather hard to miss. Another thing, actually, is if you actually look at the hull, look at the bow, you'll see that in Gneisenau's case, she has a raised strip running along from her main belt that runs basically all the way up to the forward anchor that's quite visible, whereas on Bismarck you can see that that raised profile ends just forward of Anton turret. What else can you see? Well, you might think the little bit sticking up right up top is a difference, but actually that's somewhat variable. Some photos of Bismarck have it, some don't. But other rather notable differences, you've got the kind of golf ball secondary fire directors, and on Bismarck, if you're looking from a bow view, you can see there's one on each side. You can see the port side one here, obviously, at a level just above Bruno turret, but further back. And then after that, you've got this socking great crane arm. Whereas if you look on Gneisenau, you can see that there are two such golf ball directors on either side, one lower than the other, fairly easily visible. Other noticeable differences are that you can see kind of the bridge window structure. Bismarck's is a little bit flatter with considerably wider wings. Bismarck has considerably more top structure above said bridge. And then if you look a little bit further down to where the conning tower is positioned, once again, Bismarck's structure there is considerably wider. Now, there are obviously a lot of other incidental minor differences that you could be pointing out, but those are the, you know, the biggest and most obvious ones. So, yeah, confusing Gneisenau and or Scharnhorst with Bismarck or Tirpitz, that's not really very easy to explain. Almirante Brown asks, I was surprised by the many types of Bofors naval artillery advertised in the 1913 Naval Annual. Did Swedish firms alone or as part of an international consortia actively seek foreign naval contracts in the 1900s and 1910s? What kind of upgrades to Sweden's naval infrastructure would have been required for Swedish companies to have had a chance at winning first and second generation dreadnought contracts? Swedish firms generally weren't looking for international shipbuilding contracts in a large scale, at least. They would aim for some smaller ones for minor nations and so forth, as Bofors could position itself as kind of a true neutral when it came to arms supply, kind of like the Switzerland of heavy naval artillery. But Swedish shipyards just weren't really capable of manufacturing, you know, dozens and dozens of ships all at the same time, certainly not warships. But when it comes to the number of Bofors naval artillery guns in that naval annual, one of the things you have to remember is that at that particular time, you're looking at a little bit of a snapshot, because Bofors, up until 2 years before that annual, had a fairly major competitor in Sweden. But then Bofors essentially overwhelmed it, took it over, shut it down and consolidated it all into one. So essentially that catalogue, what you're looking at is almost the combined catalogue of two separate arms manufacturers, which is why there are so many similar calibre weapons. In terms of upgrading naval infrastructure for Swedish companies to win first and second generation dreadnought contracts. Well, for the second generation, that would require Bofors to manufacture something like a 13, 14 inch gun or thereabouts, something to actually fit onto those ships. As far as first generation dreadnought contracts go, obviously the Bofors 11 inch gun as found on the Sverige class, you could install on a smaller dreadnought. Most first gen dreadnoughts went for the 12 inch gun, but of course the Germans went for the 11 inch, so that's not necessarily completely ruled out. The bigger problem really would be the size of Swedish yards and the capability of manufacturing the other components for a ship. Now, Bofors could make the armor for ships of that generation, but yeah, you'd first have to make a slipway, I guess, probably, rather than a graving dock, large enough to actually build the ship. And you'd still have to source things like the engines and so forth from overseas. So, honestly, it was probably better if you did want a ship built with Bofors naval artillery to get the ship built somewhere else and have the guns shipped from Sweden to the ship rather than try and build a ship, have all the guns and armor available, but have to ship in rather major components from like the engines and so forth, which needed fairly early in the build process, to Sweden. And of course, with all that expanded naval infrastructure, you need to build a dreadnought, a substantial sized dreadnought in Sweden. You'd also need all the relevant cranes and other transportation infrastructure capable of supporting the large loads that you'd need to build such a vessel. So it's not just about, hey, we've extended the slipway a little bit. You'd have to completely overhaul the shipyard's infrastructure as well. Michael Latichuk asks, the Soviet fleet had an overwhelming advantage over Axis powers in the Black Sea. What is the cause of its poor performance, and could you name any actions or achievements that might otherwise vindicate it? There's a combination of factors. Partly, the Soviet fleet, although it had a numerical and displacement advantage over the Axis navies in the Black Sea, was generally speaking relatively old, so a lot of its ships had minimal anti-torpedo defences, and that meant that even the relative handful of torpedo boats, destroyers, and submarines in the service of the various Axis or Axis-aligned navies could potentially take down a fairly substantial target if given the opportunity, even if it was the last thing that they did. So that made the Soviets rather understandably cautious. Another factor was the fact that they might have naval superiority. They didn't have air superiority, and the Luftwaffe was fairly practiced by this point at attacking ships. And given that the Soviets didn't really have all that much in the way of viable anti-aircraft defenses, it was something of a miracle they didn't lose more ships to Luftwaffe air attack than they did historically, possibly due to the fact that most of the actually anti-shipping trained Luftwaffe units were over in the Mediterranean at the time, but that's another conversation. So you can't really mass and deploy a large fleet to try and do something. Well, one, you don't have another big fleet to fight, so what exactly are you going to do? Are you going to sail up and do some shore bombardment? Well, you can do that more safely with a fewer ships. And if you do mass your fleet together, well, that's a fairly big target for aforementioned Luftwaffe attacks. And, well, that's not a good thing when you don't really have much of a way of repelling them. Another factor is, of course, you have things like the siege of Sevastopol and so forth. So you've got a lot of the fleet engaged in running supplies and reinforcements to and casualties and evacuees from the siege, which is fairly taxing on the ships and costs them a fair number of ships as well, usually to air attack. So they do have other useful and viable things to do. So at the end of the day, it comes down to the Soviet fleet is doing what it can in an incredibly hostile environment where most of the potential attacks are contested from the air. And honestly, there's not a huge much else that they can do, because if they deploy their big, heavy assets, it's very likely that something will go after them, and that will result in a fairly major ship loss, or at least heavy damage. And compounding all of this is the fact that Stalin, who is very, very sensitive about his big shiny ships getting lost, is gradually pulling a tighter and tighter rein on the various Soviet fleets, especially the Black Sea Fleet, to the point that by about midway through the war, he just flat out forbids them from sending anything particularly substantial out of port, because he's worried it'll get destroyed and he doesn't want the prestige and propaganda victory that that would hand the Axis, even though, you know, numerous other large ships had been destroyed on all sides. But again, Stalin's very sensitive about these kinds of things. APT Waffle Mantis asks, what do you think will be the next drastic change in naval power comparable to the torpedo, the dreadnought, or the aircraft carrier? Now, as regular viewers will know, I usually don't cover anything post-1950, but as this is speculative and to a certain degree can be based on historical precedents, I'm going to make a brief exception to cover this question. Personally, I think there's two major shifts that, if anyone is sensible, we're likely to see in future naval construction. Now, obviously, I don't know everything there is to know about modern naval warfare. There are probably significant advances going on in, for example, submarine technology that, well, no one who actually knows about them is going to be at liberty to talk about, and I certainly don't. But in terms of surface ships, I think that we are either heading for, or should be heading for, considerably larger ships, and we're probably going to see a significant return of gun-based armaments at varying sizes. Unfortunately, probably not battleship grade, but certainly in the form of close and medium-range weapon systems, and potentially with lasers, like you can see Dragonfire here, supplementing that. Now, the reason I say that is because of two things. Firstly, when you're looking at the new thing that everybody thinks is going to dominate every battlefield everywhere all the time, i.e. drones, yes, they are a substantial threat. And actually, this poses a significant problem for existing warships, because for many years, in fact, decades now, warships, at least in terms of escort vessels, destroyers and frigates and so forth, have been trending towards mirror matching the kind of threats that high-end peer opponents have been looking to throw at them. So you initially had anti-shipping missiles, fairly basic subsonic ones, then you went to sea skimmers, then you went to supersonics, now they're talking about hypersonics. But essentially, the missile threat, the primary threat that these ships are designed to defend against, has become individually potentially slightly larger, but numerically somewhat smaller, but somewhat more capable. The engagement time is much reduced. It used to be that if someone launched a massive wave of subsonic anti-shipping missiles at you, your restriction was essentially your magazine size, because you could engage all of them until you ran out of missiles before the first lot hit, assuming you had decent radar. These days, however, really, really fast missiles, your main restriction is how quickly you can react and how many missiles you can coordinate in the air, because a hypersonic missile coming over the horizon is going to hit you much, much faster than you can mag dump your ship. And so there's been this trend to bigger, more expensive, far more capable anti-aircraft missiles, which makes a certain amount of sense. But now you have drones thrown in on top of that. And the problem is that a drone might be cheap, cheerful, and rather pathetic looking next to a supersonic or hypersonic missile, but it's still a major threat. Some of them will have the power explosively to seriously threaten the ship's integrity and survival. Others might not, but they will still carry the power, explosive and shrapnel wise, to damage and knock out systems like, say, your radar and your fire control systems, which will then impede your capability to deal with the bigger, nastier threats. And that, of course, means that every single threat in an attack wave, whether it be a, if you like, proper anti-shipping missile or some overgrown moped with wings, has to be dealt with. The problem is that, well, if you've got smaller and smaller magazines of increasingly more and more expensive missiles, somebody could basically get a net win by firing off a couple of hundred thousand dollars worth of flying mopeds. And if you expend maybe a dozen proper surface-to-air missiles plus some gun shells to deal with them all, well, you've probably spent $20-30 million, which, net score-wise, they've won that one by a factor of about 10, even if they didn't do any damage, because they forced you to expend a lot more money. And so that's why I think guns are on their way back, because realistically, the only way to relatively economically counter these swarms of low individual threat, low speed, fragile drone assaults is to have an extensive battery of guns. Now, whether that be 40 mil, the Phalanx 20 mil CRWS, I think, is past its use by date, really. But, it could be 30, 35 mil, could be 40 mil, could be 57 mil, slightly bigger installation. The Italians are very fond of that one. Or 75 mil, 3-inch, etc. Whatever the case, I think you're going to see a lot more of those because shells are relatively cheap and can deal with those kinds of threats. And if you've got enough of them, especially my idea of a twin 40 mil installation, you potentially even have a viable secondary line of defense against hypersonics, because as long as you can fling those shells out just far enough, you don't necessarily have to hit an incoming high-speed missile. You just have to put a big cloud of debris in front of it, 40 mil frag rounds, and then when it hits those, it's going to come apart. And that's why you have to hit them far enough out, because otherwise you just get shotgunned by fragments. But anyway, so that's why I think guns are probably going to see a bit of a comeback. And of course, if, as and when laser technology comes fully to fore, you might see those integrated as well. I personally think, as well as guns, you might see some navies try to rely purely on a laser. But given that there are a few circumstances where a laser might be severely attenuated when a shell wouldn't be, like severe fog or something like that, or mist, I'd hope people were sensible enough to have both. And again, the swarming threat comes back to why I think we're going to see larger ships, because larger ships can carry larger and more numerous sensors, less vulnerable to things like ECM and EW, because, well, they've got more power apart from anything else. But also, one of the big problems faced by, I think, current combatants is that if somebody has a whole slew of cheap and cheerful stuff, whether they be the flying mopeds or a bunch of need to use in the next couple of years silkworms or whatever, because they're cheap and therefore can be fairly numerous, a potential aggressor, whether that be, someone like the Houthis or someone a little bit more civilized and advanced, can potentially fire off dozens, if not hundreds, of these things. You still have to counter all of them, but then you run out of missiles in your magazines. Then what do you do? Because at that point, if you're dangerously low out of missiles, you either have to withdraw, in which case the other guy wins, or you have to hope that they haven't kept their handful of actually capable anti-shipping missiles for now, and if they're sensible, they have, they launch those, and oh look, you don't actually have your primary line of defense anymore. You have to rely on close-in weapon systems and hope that they get them all, which is not a bet I would want to be making necessarily if there's, a dozen actual capable anti-shipping missiles coming at you. At which point, there is a very, very strong argument for a considerably larger ship than the 8 to 10,000 ton destroyers that you see most commonly used for air defense amongst the larger navies of the world. Instead, I would say you probably want a minimum price of entry of 15-16,000 tonner, and for smaller navies like the UK, which just, let's face it, we're not going to be building dozens and dozens of anti-air escorts anytime soon, you probably want to build something even bigger, 23-25,000 tons, because, well, half a dozen of those will be infinitely more effective than half a dozen substantially smaller vessels, because one, square cube law is your friend, much more internal hull volume, and two, something that size can essentially be self-supporting and doesn't necessarily need an additional escort ship with it to help it out. Hopefully, if you design it properly anyway. And that will give you much greater magazine depth for your general expensive missiles, plus extensive magazine depth for shorter range missiles like CRAM or Sea Scepter, plus plenty of deck space and length to mount a good number of gun-based defense systems. And that should mean that you should have a fair degree of confidence that any arbitrary amount of swarming attacks can be dealt with by your cheaper gun-based and potentially short-range missile-based defense systems while still retaining plenty of ammo in reserve, and you have the capability of dealing with a fairly large saturation attack from more capable weapon systems, and it means at the end of that battle you don't have to go home because you've run out of ammunition, because, yeah, you might only, quote-unquote, expend 15 to 20% of your ammunition in that engagement, but that means you can be there the next day if the enemy tries it again, and the next day if they try it again after that, and so on and so forth. And even if you've burned through 60, 70% of your ammunition, you still have a, you know, maybe 100 or so missiles aboard, at least several dozen, plus your guns, which means if you then have to make a withdrawal, you can still withdraw with substantial cover available to yourself, which you see is all good for your survivability. So you don't get forced to cede the field. And of course, you'll have plenty of space aboard the ship, not just for your sensors and your defensive weaponry, but also potentially for offensive weaponry, whether that be drones of your own, cruise missiles, etc., etc., to hopefully cut off the source of the people who are shooting lots of things at you. I know there's this near obsession at the moment in some circles with networked, distributed protean. Good grief, I hear that term again, I'm going to stab somebody. Designs, i.e. kind of ship drone swarms. But frankly speaking, it's a dumb idea, because anyone with a small degree of sense will just go, lots of independent small vessels that are individually not particularly capable. I wonder what happens if I do jamming or disruption or separation. And even then, even without all of that in place, which, let's face it, any vaguely sensible peer opponent is going to do, your individual vessels are more vulnerable. They're much easier to pick off. And if you do send them individually rather than in a mass swarm, they're very, very easy to overwhelm. And of course, when one of them's overwhelmed, then even if you then send a fleet in, well, that fleet is degraded compared to what it would have been because a portion of it is already missing. BK Zhong asks, aside from the 2nd Pacific Squadron having a trail of sharks and the time the Brazilian Navy attacked dolphins by mistake, can you think of any cases where larger marine animals got involved in Navy operations? Well, there's obviously the attempts in World War I by the British to train seals or sea lions, depending on your source, as submarine hunters. Well, that didn't go particularly well. Too easily distracted by fish. Then you have whales, and unfortunately whales tend usually to be at the receiving end of mistaken naval operations. It's not uncommon during World War II to read accounts from various escort formations prosecuting what they think is a submarine contact, but after some time they come to the unfortunate conclusion that actually what they've been doing is chasing down some poor unfortunate whale with depth charges and so forth. I'll leave it up to your imagination quite how they work that one out. But that's not to say the whales entirely are on the negative side of things, because you do have a tale going all the way back to the Byzantine period of a particularly large whale. No one's entirely sure what species, but one apparent particularly large whale that decided to terrorize what was at the time Byzantium-Constantinople's harbour, which caused no end of kerfuffle for several years until the problem was eventually dealt with. You also, of course, have semi-regular occurrences of sharks going after survivors of shipwrecks and ships sunk in enemy action in the various tropical climes where sharks are present in very large numbers and of substantial size. But broadly speaking, most marine animals' involvement with full-scale warships tends to be at the age of sail, when it's a little bit harder for them to detect said warships, for the sailors to either go, oh look, cool, a thing, we shall determine whether this is a good or a bad omen, or oh look, a thing, I wonder if it's tasty. And then once you get to the era of steam and steel, when you've got engines and propellers going thump, 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 thump through the water, mysteriously, contacts with large marine animals tend to be significantly reduced because most of them hear the thing coming from, you know, a dozen miles away and go, I don't want anything to do with this, and just swim off. A few don't, and occasionally they get rammed and so forth, which also isn't great, but there you go. Warrant Officer Will asks, you've mentioned in a previous dry dock that Jarrowwood was incredible in all but the fact it was an absolute pain to machine and almost impossible to do so once it had hardened. But with the British Empire being the British Empire, they had the resources and exclusive access to it. So did they try anyway and build some kind of warship out of Jarrowwood? As far as I'm aware, no, they didn't try that. In part because although Jarra is, as I've mentioned before, substantially stronger even than White and Live Oak, it is a little bit denser, unsurprisingly, so it's a little bit heavier. So you would need to take that into account when you're building your ship to make sure it's not sitting too low in the water. But the main problem is actually twofold. Yes, it's very difficult to actually, you know, deal with in terms of shaping and so forth. That would be a major problem because at the time that you're talking about making ships out of wood, generally, you need to do that with hand tools and maybe some very, very basic powered tools. That it means you're not just talking about worn out blades, you're talking about huge amounts of exhausting work. And that's not going to be very popular or very economical. So it's going to cost you an absolute fortune. Plus, where is it? The wood, it's in Australia. Australia in the Age of Sail is not particularly heavily populated. It's not particularly heavily industrialized. There aren't going to be substantial shipyards there. And therefore, even if someone had gotten into their head that they wanted to build a warship out of Jarrowwood, the facilities just don't exist to actually, you know, do so on any significant scale in Australia, you know, in the, what, 1840s and before. Not to mention, of course, that for all the blunted blades and broken tools you'd be creating, you'd have to be importing most of those, which would be an even more expensive process. And I suppose in theory, you could get a bunch of Jarrowwood and haul it off to somewhere with bigger shipyards to then turn into a warship. But by the time it actually got there and had seasoned properly, it's now going to have hardened substantially. And well, yeah, just forget it at that point with 18th and 17th century tooling. Admiral asks, how was Dreadnought so much larger than its predecessor? Well, it depends how you define much larger. It's about 15% larger than the Lord Nelson's in terms of displacement, just under 2,000 tons heavier, and about 16% longer, 527 feet versus 443. So, you know, yes, it's larger, but I wouldn't necessarily say it's massively, massively larger. Although you can see in this photo, she does look, admittedly with the help of a bit of foreground perspective, substantially bigger than her pre-Dreadnought contemporaries who are just behind her. But you've got to bear in mind that building a ship of this size isn't unknown for the building industry at the time. I mean, the armoured cruisers that are under construction at the time are, admittedly, yes, they weigh slightly less, they display slightly less than a pre-Dreadnought battleship, for the most part. But things like the Minotaur class are much, much closer in length to Dreadnought as compared to a battleship. And at the same time, you have the shipbuilding industry quite happily building and sending out to sea ships that are substantially bigger than Dreadnought in the civilian world. I mean, the Lusitania, admittedly, she's launched and entered service a little bit after Dreadnought, but she's actually started well before Dreadnought. And Lusitania displaces 44,000 tons, you know, more than double what Dreadnought does. And she's a couple of hundred feet, well, more than a couple of hundred feet longer as well. Oh, and that reminds me, while I'm thinking about it, well, here's Indefatigable, the notorious battlecruiser, but still battlecruiser, so a fairly substantial vessel. And that's RMS Olympic, Titanic's sister ship and immediate predecessor, in the background. And you can see the Olympic is a substantially larger vessel even than the battlecruiser, and that's with the benefit of course, Indefatigable being closer to us and thus benefiting from some additional foreground perspective compared to Olympic, which is going to appear relatively slightly smaller than she actually is by being further away. So essentially, Dreadnought being so much bigger than a Lord Nelson class pre-Dreadnought is essentially down to, well, she needs a larger hull to accommodate all those big guns and the hull form for higher speed because of the turbine engines. And, well, now there's actually a strong enough justification and push for it to get the Treasury to release the funds to build a ship of that size. And so they did. There wasn't anything especially unique about the capability of building a ship of that size and shape. It was just the first time someone had done it for a battleship. Of course, you know, even going back to the Great Eastern, as you saw in the April 1st video, the Great Eastern, even though she would, had she survived up until the mid-1900s, have been more than 50 years old at that point, was also a substantially larger ship than Dreadnought. Fennec Fox asks, speaking of USS Texas, her new home is in Galveston, and she has two nearby neighbours, USS Stewart and USS Kavala. My question is, did Texas ever serve with Stewart? I know Texas and Kavala were involved in at least one of the Pacific landing operations together, but I don't know if Texas and Stewart ever escorted ships together. No, unfortunately, it doesn't appear that they actually ever operated together in World War II. I cross-referenced every single convoy that both ships were on. The closest that they came was that one of them escorted convoy UGF-10 and the other escorted UGF-12, but that's still, you know, an entire convoy separating them. And Stewart's only operational from 1943 onwards. She's often with Hunter Killer groups, which of course Texas isn't going to be with. And then Texas is doing a lot of shore fire support in 44 for D-Day and Dragoon and so forth, but then moves off to the Pacific for a substantial portion of 44-45, whereas Stewart remains in the Atlantic until almost the very end of the war. Now, interestingly, Stewart did make it to Pearl Harbor right towards the very end of World War II, and Texas was on her way back, but it doesn't appear that they were both in Pearl Harbor at the same time, even right at the end of the war. The Bashar asks, why didn't you go into further detail regarding the Smith versus Smith argument in Saipan? And why did you imply that General Ralph Smith was at fault as opposed to Holland Smith? I feel this was a major oversight on your part. I did get a number of fairly extensive and very politely written emails about this, actually, at the time the episode came out. So I thought, well, when we get to the dry dock that covers it, there's almost certainly going to be somebody asking a similar question in the comments, which, of course, they did. And I thought this is probably the easiest way of covering why I covered that dispute the way that I did in that video. And that is essentially boils down to the fact that, well, two things. Firstly, I'm telling in that video the story of Spruance, not the story of either Ralph or Holland Smith. Secondly, as I've said before, I'm not a land-based military historian. Well, I physically exist on land, but I don't have, you know, substantial knowledge about army and land-based operations the way that I know the Navy. And likewise for air operations, but land operations are the important thing here. So therefore, I'm not a historian who's au fait with the ins and outs and wheelings and dealings of the US Army or the US Marine Corps, apart from where the US Marine Corps' own dealings touch on the Navy's dealings. Therefore, I don't know every single detail of the background and the argument with regards to the dispute between Holland and Ralph Smith. And I'm not going to try and wade into that because, apart from anything, one of the few things I definitely know about the whole dispute is that it is still a matter of considerable contention between the Army and the Marine Corps down to this very day. And therefore, obviously, there are going to be perspectives that think that Holland Smith was completely justified in his complaints and other perspectives that are going to say that Ralph Smith was, you know, completely done over by this and it was completely unfair and everything in between. And since I don't have the time or, to be honest, any beginning of any idea of where I would look to try and evaluate all the potential sources for myself and work everything out, even assuming I understood them all, I'm not in a position to take a position on the entire argument. Therefore, what I presented in that video was a relatively short excerpt covering that the incident happened because it affected Spruance, and Spruance had to, you know, not only was the campaign affected by it, but Spruance's own, you know, decisions, etc., had a bearing on it. But what I presented was essentially what Spruance was presented with, i.e. what was the Spruance eye view of the situation? What was he being told at the time? What were his advisors and other senior officers telling him at the time? And how was that driving, you know, the decision that he ultimately had to make? So if Spruance is being told that Ralph Smith isn't making the Army Division do what it should and that the Marines are suffering as a result of it, well, that's what Spruance is told. That is what he's going to make his decision on at the time. And, you know, the fact that Spruance rather likes Ralph Smith, also pertinent to what Spruance knows and thinks at the time, therefore included. But ultimately, during the events, both during and immediately after the Battle of Saipan, Spruance is being told, essentially, by his subordinates that no matter how much he likes Ralph Smith, the army division that he's in command of, and therefore Smith himself, as you can see pictured here, is not pulling its weight, and therefore they feel he needs to go. And if Spruance is being told this by his advisors, then he is going to have to make that decision. Whether or not those representations are entirely accurate or justified, and what exactly was going on, you know, was it a difference in tactics? Was it a difference in perspective? Was there actually some morale issues or whatever between the various divisions and so forth? That detail is a matter for people who are much more versed in Marine Corps and US Army history to decide and or debate. But for a narrative history of Admiral Spruance, given that essentially everything else that I was referring to in that video and in the others surrounding Spruance is talking about essentially this is what Spruance is doing at the time, this is why he's doing it, this is the information he has on available at the time, and relatively minimal kind of hindsight, oh yes, well actually he probably should have done this or shouldn't have done this, or we now know that this was a good idea because this, that perhaps he didn't know. There wasn't really a lot of that in the video, and if I'm not going to do that in what's essentially a rather long life story for Spruance with regards to naval matters, which as I say I do substantially understand considerably better, it's not really the time or place for me to go into the ins and outs of exactly which Smith was right or not. As I said, that's much better covered by other historians. And therefore, all I'm saying in that video is, this is the situation Spruance was given, this is what he was told, therefore he did this, now we move on. If the operational reality is actually somewhat different, then of course you have things like the Unauthorized History of the Pacific War podcast, where they do have people who know substantially more about the Army and Marine Corps, dispute over the whole issue and what the actual reality may or may not be in that situation. Patrick Donnelly asks, had the US Navy developed a night carrier doctrine during the interwar period, could any of the aircraft they flew before the Avenger be fitted with radar, and how would it impact their operations and battles during the first year of the Pacific War? Yes, you absolutely could. I mean, using the weight of ASV Mark II, which obviously was the British air surface radar that replaced the somewhat unliked ASV Mark I fairly quickly and was around about the time the US was entering World War II anyway, and would later be fitted under different names and guises to various US aircraft, you can see here one fitted to a Swordfish. Now, it does look very bulky, fair enough, but it actually doesn't weigh all that much. Various sources list its all-up weight as between 150 and 200 pounds. And as you can see, you've got the antenna mounted on the wings. So Swordfish can carry it. Pretty much any US aircraft that's in carrier service at the start of World War II could carry it. But you do need an operator for it, and it does impact on the overall speed and agility because of the additional drag it generates. So I definitely wouldn't be sticking it on a fighter like a Wildcat, but an SBD, the Dauntless, or the TBD, the Devastator, both of those could carry this kind of radar. Now, of the two, it might initially be tempting to follow the British idea with the Swordfish and fit it to the Devastator, because you have three crew members, so you've still got your tail gunner, your pilot, and your navigator can now also operate the radar. However, there are a limited number of torpedo bombers on US Navy ships compared to Dauntlesses, and as you can see with the Swordfish, if you do fit this radar, you're essentially occupying the space where you would put a torpedo. So my theory would be that, well, you've got one squadron of Dauntlesses already set up as a scout squadron, so fit some of those with surface air-to-surface radar, because the Dauntless can carry smaller, lighter bombs on the wings, much the same way as you can see the Swordfish doing here. So while you are taking up the primary hard point, so it won't be able to lug around the 1,000-pounder, simply because the radar will almost certainly be in the way, you can still take the lighter bomb loads that are typical of a scouting Dauntless anyway. And you have the extra crew member, so your rear gunner can do radar operation, because let's face it, while you're searching for the enemy, if you come under air attack, your gunner can switch back to being a gunner fairly quickly. And in the period when he's most likely to be needed as a rear gunner, i.e. while you're actively attacking an enemy target, well, by that point, the radar's already done its job. So, yeah, I think scouting Dauntlesses would probably be the best aircraft to fit this radar too. In terms of impacting operations, there are a number of cases where it would be very useful. I mean, obviously, some airborne sweeps and searches for Japanese ships that just missed them might very well pick them up, but you might also get some attacks in from unexpected angles or unexpected times, which might significantly help the US cause overall. So, for example, at the Battle of the Coral Sea, you have some Dauntlesses showing up to attack Shikaku and Zuikaku, and they're not able to find the carriers. A couple of them are, but you know, not that many compared to the number of Dauntlesses that are looking for them because of low cloud cover. Whereas if you'd had two or three radar-equipped Dauntlesses in with that group, then if you tell everyone else, hey, follow the Dauntless that has the weird bulge on the underside, and it goes, ah, yes, they're over here, even through the cloud, well, that gives you a double advantage. One, everyone can attack, and two, the Japanese can't shoot at you until you emerge from the cloud base, which shortens your period in danger and gives you the advantage of surprise. So the Battle of the Coral Sea might have ended with either more damage to Shikaku and damage at all to Zuikaku, or possibly even with one of them sunk. And in various other carrier battles and carrier strikes on land, it might extend the strike time of US aircraft, because quite a number of times in multiple different engagements, a US admiral makes a decision roughly mid-afternoon to forestall any further flight ops except for combat air patrol, simply because even if there's a chance that they've spotted the enemy, or they've perhaps just spotted the enemy, by the time they've got everybody fueled up, loaded, launched, on their way, done their strike, they'll be coming back during the night, which obviously they're not really trained for, they're not really very keen on doing. Whereas if you've got a bunch of radar-equipped scouts, then you have a twofold use for them. Firstly, you have a much more guaranteed method of getting to the target beyond, well, you're more likely to find them in the first place and then hold them and guide other aircraft in, which makes the strike attempt more worthwhile. But also, on the way back, you can have your radar-equipped Dauntlesses tasked to lead columns of aircraft. So, obviously, you'd ideally prefer not to be coming back in the middle of the night, but if the opportunity is there to hit the enemy in late afternoon or early evening, then you can take that and then tell everyone, okay, well, as the light fades, follow again the weirdly shaped Dauntless. When the light goes completely, that Dauntless can maybe turn on a running light or something so that everyone knows roughly where it is, And that Dauntless can then use a combination of the homing beacon and its radar to more accurately find the carrier that it's supposed to be going back to. And then everyone else is like, well, hey, he's just landed. Oh, look, there's the carrier. Let's all go home. Jeffrey Connolly asks, the design of the Italian training ship, the Amerigo Vespucci, was apparently based off the Kingdom of the Two Sicilies ship of the line, the Monarca. However, I can't really find any information on that vessel. Could you give us a quick history of it? Well, here she is. The Monarca was originally built, as you noted, for the Kingdom of the Two Sicilies at the start of the 1850s. Now, one of the things you'll notice from this photo, she's a two-decker, so she's a two-deck ship of the line armed with 84 guns, which theoretically makes her a heavy third rate by the classic Age of Sail ship of the line classifications. But at the time that she was being built, the first rate was, you know, 120-plus gun three-decker, quite substantially bigger than most classic Age of Sail ships of the line that were first rates. And the second rate as a short three-decker had kind of fallen away, and most second rates of the 1840s, 1850s were two-deckers with mid-80s to low to mid-90s numbers of guns. So by the period, she was technically classified as a second rate. However, even at the time of her launch, screw-powered or at least steam auxiliary ships of the line were definitely a thing in service, and she was originally just a sailing vessel. And so in the late 1850s, she was taken into dry dock to be fitted with a steam engine, but unlike some ship of the line conversions, this wasn't done by cutting the ship in half and putting in an extra section that also held the steam engine, which preserved the overall firepower. Instead, they literally just cut open the top, popped in a steam engine and a screw propeller and called it a day, which had two negative effects. Firstly, the additional space that took up meant that she went down to being a 64 gunner, so kind of dropping out of the contention of being a ship of the line, depending on who you asked. But also, the screw propeller was not the world's best design, and so initially she was only capable of making around 4 knots, although when she had a new propeller fitted, that went up to 8 knots, which still wasn't fantastic by the standards of the time, but it was much more in line with the lower end of generic steam-powered ships of the line of the period. Of course, this was also the time period when Italy was going from being a whole series of different kingdoms into being, well, Italy, the Kingdom of Italy. And initially, some of the, I guess, unification forces tried to capture her. That didn't work out particularly well. But when the Kingdom of the Two Sicilies had a governmental collapse and the king fled, at that point, the majority of the navy actually then turned around and joined the unification forces. So at that point, which was 1860, she was renamed Re Galantuomo, I think. Galantuomo, maybe? And then in 1861, she became part of the Regia Marina. But a combination of relatively slow speed under steam, unreliable machinery, and that significant reduction in armament meant that although for a brief period she was the largest ship in Italian service, she was rapidly overhauled by newer, larger, and more modern warships. And by the time of the Battle of Lissa, she wasn't considered a frontline warship anymore, so she wasn't there. And then she would eventually be scrapped in the mid-1870s. But, as you mentioned in your question, in the 1920s, when it came time to build a pair of sail-based training vessels, the designer essentially, although the interior was much different, took the exterior lines of the ship and turned out two vessels, one of which is still in Italian service. DM Phoenix asks, when it comes to a ship's position of second in command, executive officer, first mate, first lieutenant, etc., does the captain have unilateral power to appoint this position, or does the admiralty, or the ship's owner in the case of a commercial vessel, have a say in the matter too? And how much does the captain's personal relationship with that person factor into the decision compared to skills and qualifications? It's one of those wonderful questions where it varies hugely depending on navy, time period, and also the personal cachet of the captain in question, plus circumstances, to be honest. So in the latter period of the time period the channel covers, as you get more into the modern era, the captain usually has very little power over the appointment of his executive officer under default conditions, because exos will be on their own separate command path, usually heading off to be captains of their own at some point. And thus you might start your time as captain of a ship with a given exo, but they may be transferred out to their own command or something else partway during your term in command and you get a new one. Or you might be lucky enough to start with a brand new exo, so you're both in the same commission for roughly the same period. Although obviously the flip side to that is that if you inherit an exo from a previous captain, then hopefully if the exo is any good, the ship's already running pretty well. Whereas if you start with a new exo, well, both of you have got to learn your job on the new ship pretty darn quickly. Now, the further back in time you go, the more likely it is that a captain will have a lot more influence over who gets assigned as a first officer, simply because when you go further back, ships tended to come into commission and then they'd get their officer cadre and then they'd go out of commission and then the officer cadre would leave. If they stayed in commission for a very, very, very long time, you might get new officers cycling through, but a lot of the time, the same team would be in command for most, if not all, of that ship's commission. Obviously, circumstances did vary. We're talking about the age of sail, essentially, here. And at that point, then captains would have a bit more say over who they wanted as an officer. Although usually they would have a bit more say about who they didn't get as an officer, more so than who they did. So you might have a letter saying, well, you know, I appreciate that the Admiralty has selected such and such as my first lieutenant, but I really, really can't stand the man and would prefer somebody else. That would be more common than, you know, thank you for appointing me captain of the ship. I would like to bring this officer aboard as my first officer. However, that's not impossible in the time period. As I said, it depends a lot on circumstances and the cachet of the captain. So if you're an up-and-comer with a lot of political clout and a lot of fame to your name, or you're just really well-liked by your superiors, then if you send a letter saying, Dear Lords of the Admiralty, thank you very much for appointing me captain of this third-rate ship of the line or this frigate, I would very much like to bring my good friend so-and-so as first officer, then you're very much more likely to be granted that, as opposed to if you're just a generic captain. And of course, you know, if a captain dies and perhaps the first lieutenant is felt not to be senior enough or experienced enough to take over as captain on a permanent basis, you just get parachuted in. You ain't getting rid of that first lieutenant very easily. Of course, if you really want to get rid of someone because you are having a personality clash, but they're also a reasonable officer in the abstract, then one of the ways you might do that is to recommend them for command. So send them off to be post-captain of a small ship. Again, we're talking about the age of sail. At which point you can say, well, hey, look, my first officer, I'd really hate to see him go, but he is good enough to command his own ship. And, well, since this is a little bit out of line of the commission decommissioning paying off cycle, well, can you send me this guy, who I happen to like, as the new officer? Of course, you then have to potentially smooth over ruffled feathers amongst the existing crew who may be looking for promotion themselves. Tankodromus asks, what would be your take on the unrealised refits that were allowed to Italy and France after the Washington Treaty? How big a refit could they have been, and what would it involve, in your opinion? So the section, for those of you following along at home with your own copy of the Washington Naval Treaty, is Part 3, Section 1, Part D, Section 1. Yeah, I know, it's weird. So there it reads, no retained capital ships or aircraft carriers shall be reconstructed except for the purpose of providing means of defence against air and submarine attack, subject to the following rules. The contracting powers may, for that purpose, equip existing tonnage with a bulge or blister or anti-air attack deck protection, providing the increase of displacement thus affected does not exceed 3,000 tonnes displacement for each ship. No alterations in side armour, in calibre, number or general type of mounting of main armament shall be permitted except, in the case of France and Italy, which countries within the limits allowed for bulge, i.e. the 3,000 tonnes, may increase their armour protection and the calibre of the guns now carried on the existing capital ships so as not to exceed 16 inches. There's a separate section about Renown allowed to complete her armour upgrades as well. Well, initially I don't think it does them a huge amount of good, because, frankly, the next generation of gun that Italy and France are designing at the end of the 1910s, beginning of the 1920s, is a 15-inch. And with the best will in the world, the Conte de Cavours, the Duilios, the Britannias, well, let's not even go with the Corbeaux, they just do not have the space in within their barbettes to accommodate upgrades to twin 15-inch, whether that be from the 13.4-inch of the Britannias or the 12-inch of the Italian ships. You could potentially make an argument at a squeeze for getting a twin 15-inch in place of the two triple or three triple 12-inch on the Italian ships. But then what do you do about the super-firing twins? Because otherwise you've only got six guns and one of them in an awkward position amidships, which is where you want to put a bunch more machinery, ideally. Now, devoting some of that extra weight to armour protection, that I could see certainly as a useful thing. I mean, neither ship is particularly well protected, or ships, I should say, considering the Italians do have two separate classes of 12-inch dreadnought, at least once they get rid of Dante Alighieri. Now, if I was going to do some refit taking advantage of these clauses, I would actually try and do it for the French in the early to mid-1930s. So in both cases, Italian and French, they do have the advantage of the ships having a distributed armour scheme. So you could remove the extreme end armour, which still adds up to a reasonable amount of weight, which would save you even more weight going in. And especially with the Britannias, which are the slightly better protected in the first place, you could probably then get at least a reasonable approximation of an all-or-nothing armour scheme with maybe 13 or a bit more inches of belt armour, which would then give them a pretty decent amount of citadel protection. And the reason I would be doing that refit in the early to mid-1930s is because it would allow me to replace the 13.4-inch guns with the same 13-inch guns that would be being planned for the Dunkirk class. Now, yes, it's 0.4 of an inch less, but they are far, far, far more modern guns with much better range and armor penetration. And so they would actually become simply more powerful vessels in terms of guns. So you got a broadside of 10 of those by default, plus a decent amount of armor. The only thing that's really lacking there is speed, and at that point, with that amount of firepower, you could potentially make a decent argument, especially given their size, that you do something like the Italian refits did historically, stick a bow extension on, strip out the amidships turret, stick in a bunch of machinery, especially with the French forced induction boilers, and you might be able to then get the Britannias armoured with eight modern 13-inch guns and decent armour up to a pretty decent speed. For the Italians, well, they pretty much did that anyway with the modernizations, you know, that they did. They pretty much took what they were allowed to do under the treaty to its maximum and a little bit beyond, depending on what you believe their pre- and post-modernization displacements were. But broadly speaking, what the Italians did with the Dorias and the Cavours, I think that's pretty much the maximum you're going to get, because Italy doesn't have the equivalent of the French 13-inch gun to relatively easily swap out the main armament. So boring out the 12-inch guns is probably the only real way they can go, unless you want to go into complete absurdities, because you have that triple and twin layout, which kind of forbids you from you being able to really just wholesale replace with some newly developed gun, because whatever you develop that's a twin mount that could replace the triple 12 is going to be too big to replace the twin 12. And if you develop something that you can just about squeeze into the twin 12, then it's probably going to be relatively low firepower for installing in the triple. Although, of course, if you did want to rip out the entire barbette system and essentially rebuild the ship from scratch, then you could stick something big in, like six twin 15s or something, sure, but then you're really pushing the limits there. Rob Smith asks, I'm in the middle of listening to Dry Dock 351 Part 1, and your answer to the question about standard and deep loading made me think. In the World War I and World War II era, was there any ship that could circumnavigate the globe without having to refuel or restock? Well, it depends how rules lawyery you want to be about circumnavigating the globe, because in theory, you could take a ship as far south towards the Antarctic as possible before you hit the ice packs and just go around Antarctica, technically you are then crossing every line of longitude, and it's about 11,000-12,000 miles, which a surprising number of World War One, World War Two era ships would be capable of doing, but I think that is very much cheating the definition. The sort of more traditional, quickest and shortest circumnavigation of the globe would be about 25,000 miles, give or take. And that would be, you could start at the Panama Canal or the Strait of Gibraltar, but essentially you, let's start at the Strait of Gibraltar. You go across the Atlantic through the Panama Canal, across the northern tip of Australia. Once you cross the Pacific, cut up through the Indian Ocean and up through the Suez Canal, through the Mediterranean and back to the Straits of Gibraltar again. And say that's about 25,000 miles. And that in turn is about 22,000 nautical miles. So the question is there any ship in the World War I, World War II fleets of various navies which can go 22,000 nautical miles? And the answer is, as far as I can tell, none of the surface ships. Some of the ones that come close are things like the Deutschland-class cruisers, but they're still falling 4,000 or 5,000 miles short. But there is a number of ships of a certain type which can, and that's submarines. So this is the USS Narwhal. She just about could do a round-the-world trip if you load fuel into every potential tank. Normal range isn't enough, but you can load ballast tanks of subs with fuel as well. The I-400 class absolutely can. The I-400 class could do a round-the-world trip with, you know, a fair bit of fuel to spare. And a number of the other large Japanese submarine classes, as well as the German Type 9D, they all come very, very close. So with a little bit of efficient sailing and or some fuel in the ballast tanks, they could probably make it. But essentially, for the World War One, World War Two era, if you want to go all the way around the world without having to refuel, you either need to be a sailing ship, which in World War One isn't necessarily out of the question, or you need to be a very large submarine, and unless you're the I-400s, you want to be loading your ballast tanks with fuel, but you can technically do it. And finally for this week, Seb Dove asks, has an air force ever been strong enough to serve as a deterrent against a naval force? Could it ever be? This probably applies for smaller nations, much in the same way as coastal battleships were a deterrent against the Germans. Well, I think it very much depends on how technical you want to be with the answer, because of course something like, say, the US Army Air Force as it was at the time, or the Royal Air Force, or you know, something like that, is going to be more than enough of a deterrent to a naval force coming from, I don't know, Civil War Spain. But that's more to do with the disparity of absolute forces between the nations in question than it is to do with the actual deterrent value of aircraft versus ships in and of itself. So if we're looking at an air force of a peer power being strong enough to serve as a deterrent to a naval force of another peer power that's roughly in shouting distance of each other, I think it would come down to, at least from my perspective, what exactly you define as a deterrent. Do you define a deterrent as absolutely restricts your opponent from doing anything in this particular space, or heavily discourages your opponent from doing something in that particular space without taking additional preparatory steps? Because those two are two very different things. For example, you could look at the Arctic convoys, and you've got the heavy escorts, the battleships, the carriers, etc., and they have to turn back by a certain point because Allied command says that, well, once you get beyond that, you've got admittedly German U-boats as well, but one of their primary concerns is German air attacks from Luftflotte 5. So is this acting as a deterrent to the Allies putting heavy ships all the way along the Arctic convoy route to safeguard them against something like Scharnhorst or Tirpitz? Practically, yes, it is, because, well, the presence of the Luftwaffe, again, complicated by the presence of U-boats, which in any combined arms operation is always going to be a factor. But primarily it's the aircraft that are deterring the Allies from sending heavy ships in. But this is not based on a, if we send them in, we are guaranteed to lose them. It's based on a calculation of risk versus reward. And the Allies basically calculating that it's far more likely that they will end up with damaged, expensive capital ships than they ever will put down a German surface raid. So, in a way, it's a deterrent, but if the Allies had absolutely wanted to, then they could have forced a capital ship force through the Arctic convoy routes. They just have to put more. So, you know, two or three carriers instead of one, three or four battleships instead of one or two. Then they would have had enough force to, you know, brave the whatever La Flotte of Five could throw at them. So it's not an absolute deterrent in that it didn't absolutely stop the Allies, but it did force them to consider either having to use an unacceptably large force or not do it. So, you know, partial deterrence achieved. Likewise, you could look at, although the Imperial Japanese Armed Forces don't have a separate Imperial Japanese Air Force at the time, the Imperial Japanese Navy's Air Force, obviously you've got the sinking of Prince of Wales and Repulse, that's a pretty big deterrent to further British activity in that area for a little while going forward. Although, again, much like the case of La Flotte 5, as would be proven by both the US Navy and the British Pacific Fleet later on, it's not so much a case of this is an absolute deterrent, i.e. there's nothing we can do. It's a case of the enemy's aircraft have a certain preponderance of force. We can overcome it with our naval forces, or at least protect well enough against it, but we need a certain size and capability of naval force to do that. You know, cruisers, battleships, carriers, etc., etc. And we don't necessarily have that at our disposal right this instant. Therefore, it is an effective deterrent at the time, but not as an absolute. So I would say, generally speaking, has there ever been an air force strong enough to serve as a deterrent against a naval force flat out in and of itself on its own? Not in absolute terms. When you're talking about peer opponents, at least in the time period the channel covers, for as long as air forces have existed, which is basically the first half of the 20th century for this channel's purposes, between peer opponents, the naval forces of the attacking party almost always did theoretically have the strength to be able to penetrate through the land-based air forces' attacks. But the amount of resources they would have to commit to doing so was very often, especially in the earlier and mid parts of the war, greater than the amount of force they wanted or could afford to bring to bear at that point, which made the deterrent effective for that period, but didn't prevent it as a whole thing. So yes, a limited deterrence, certainly in World War II, was possible, but only as long as your opponent was distracted and divided in doing a number of other tasks. So deterrence in the classic sense of the word, as in you are deterred but not prevented, not deterrence in the kind of mutually assured destruction nuclear weapons sort of way where you'd have to be mad to try, which is what people think about more nowadays. And that wraps us up for this week. Thank you very much for listening, ladies and gentlemen, and I hope to see you again in another video fairly soon. Thanks for now.